Are there patterns of thinking that restrict our ability to make meaningful social change in our society? How does authentic spirituality play into today's resistance struggles? What led to the creation of the Occupy movement, and what were the factors leading to its eventual demise? How can those at the front lines of liberation movements overcome police violence and infiltration? What are the three scenarios in which the next revolutionary moment can be built? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we attempt to examine modern-day activism and the prospects for meaningful social and political change with two individuals who've been on the forefront of some of these struggles. We'll hear from Houston-based community activist and freelance journalist Derek Brose, and we'll hear from author and Occupy Wall Street co-founder Michael White. On this week's program, Rethinking Protest, Playbooks on How to Change the World. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 29th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory in the heart of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In Iraq, U.S. terrorism from the air is back in all its genocidal force. Incredibly, on 23rd of April, The Independent reported another staggering piece of either disinformation or childish naivete in a predictably familiar script. Quote, a spokesperson for the U.S. military said all possible precautions were taken to avoid collateral damage, unquote. But in approaching 7,000 airstrikes, the number of confirmed civilian deaths had risen on Planet Pentagon to just 41. In another past its sell by date mantra, Colonel Patrick Ryder, a spokesperson for Central Command, said the casualties were, quote-unquote, deeply regretted, but maintained that the campaign was the, quote-unquote, most precise air campaign in the history of warfare. So another onslaught in a quarter of a century of bombing Iraq is underway, another mass murder with a silly name, Operation Inherent Resolve. That comes from the article, Death and Destruction in Iraq, Extensive U.S. War Crimes, Apocalypse in Mosul in the Guise of Bombing ISIS, by Felicity Arbuthnot, posted April 27th. Power, far more than fact, determines what is defined as true in America, a nation that has become dangerously disconnected from reality in matters both trivial and important. The way it works now is that, in case after case, the more powerful entity in the equation imposes the answer, and the rest of us are invited to join in by throwing stones and jeering at the weaker party. Two current examples make the point. On the more substantive side, there is the 2014 case of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 shot down over eastern Ukraine, killing 298 people and blamed by U.S. officials and the Western media on ethnic Russian rebels and Russian President Vladimir Putin. On the more personal side is the case of New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady, who has been defined by the powerful National Football League as a perjurer for denying under oath the NFL's scientifically dubious charges that he was part of a scheme to slightly deflate footballs. That comes from the article, From Brady to MH17, Power Defines Reality, by Robert Perry, posted April 27th, originally appearing at Consortium News. Iran says the deduction of around $2 billion U.S. in frozen Iranian assets recently, authorized by a U.S. court ruling, is highway robbery, vowing that the Islamic Republic will retrieve the sum. According to Press TV, last Wednesday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the money had to be turned over to the American families of the people killed in a 1983 bombing of a U.S. Marine Corps barracks in the Lebanese capital of Beirut and other attacks blamed on Iran. Iran has denied any role in the attack, and the money confiscated under the U.S. court ruling belongs to the Central Bank of Iran. Quote, "The judgment by the Supreme Court and the other even more absurd judgment by a New York circuit court deciding that Iran should pay damages for 9/11 are the height of absurdity," unquote, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif told The New Yorker in an interview published on Monday. The top Iranian diplomat asked how Americans would feel should such a thing happen to their properties. That comes from the article, U.S. Supreme Court Ruling, Seizure of $2 Billion in Iranian Assets, Highway Robbery. Posted April 27th, originally appearing at Pars Today. The Syrian government and its allies are convinced that they can beat al-Qaeda and its various associates on the battlefield. There is little the U.S. can do to help the designated terrorists of al-Nusra in West Syria. But it continues its attempts to split Syria by inserting more of its special forces into northeast Syria. These and their Kurdish proxy fighters have the task to take as much of eastern Syria from the Islamic State and others as possible before the Syrian government forces can do so. The thinking is that any captured town will be an asset in future negotiations. That comes from the article, Syria, Moscow rejects Kerry's new attempts to protect al-Qaeda terrorists, posted April 27th, originally appearing at Moon of Alabama. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Coming up later in the show, we'll hear comments from award-winning activist and Occupy Wall Street co-founder Micah White about the architecture of revolution as revealed in his recent book. But first, we'll hear an interview with Derek Brose. Derek Brose is a freelance journalist, community activist, gardener, promoter from Houston, Texas, and co-author of the book, The Conscious Resistance, Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality. He's founder of both the Houston Freethinkers and the Conscious Resistance Network and hosts the weekly podcast, The Conscious Resistance Live. In this interview, Brose discusses his involvement in independent journalism as an outgrowth from his activism, the spiritual dimension of political resistance, and he also contributes some thoughts about the standoff between militiamen and the government in Oregon a few months ago. This interview was conducted by Chris Cook for radio station CFUV in Victoria. It aired on January 6th of 2016.
Well, welcome to the program, Derek.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Chris.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Of course, now, Derek, your activism is expressed in a number of ways, a lot we can hopefully get to on your website, especially, as I've described already. But what ties these disparate efforts of yours together?
That's kind of been something I've been trying to work out myself for a while. In my personal world, I feel like I run in several circles that have intersections, that have influenced and shaped my activism, and that would be both, political activism, political awareness, concerning myself with current events, things like that, but also being involved in meditation and, more, I guess what you could term spiritual communities where I live. Both of those different viewpoints have greatly shaped the way I look at the world and from the beginning shaped my activism, but, as far as the journalism bit of it, that came through just passion and really just, kind of out of accident. I didn't go to school for journalism or anything. It just came out of a result of my persistent activism, and through that started writing a lot and getting opportunities to write for other people and to do it for a living, and now I'm in a position where I can, travel the country and cover a lot of news that you're not going to hear in the corporate media and do it independently. while, you know, working with several different independent outlets and also starting my own outlet. So it's been a great experience.
You know, I've been doing this for a long time on radio, and I didn't go to journalism school per se either. And I've often had a hard time describing myself as a journalist. You know, I don't do that for a living. I can't make money at it up here, at least haven't been able to so far. How do you consider yourself? I mean, you know, you describe a lot of the work you do, and I would call it journalism or maybe citizen journalism. How do you describe it?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, I've done a few different types of writing some that I would term journalism. You know, in the age that we're in now with the power of the internet, plenty of people, there's debates, especially among the older class of journalists and the more established newspapers and such, who they want to look down on the internet blogger, you know, or just the kid with the camera. But that's how I started, and that's how plenty of people have started. I was just, you know, all of a sudden recognizing, okay, the guy on the TV in a suit isn't any smarter than I am, or he doesn't have, you know, anything else that I don't possess. It's just that he's on TV. And so now that we have these tools, we have cameras on our phone, you can buy cheap cameras, you know, the internet, all these different tools we have our access now is really letting people become the new media. And yeah, I think it comes out of that old sort of muckraking journalism school, you know, older school of thought, and also people like Glenn Greenwald, more in the mainstream. I mean, he openly promotes adversarial journalism. You know, he said that journalism should be opposed to the establishment and should seek to expose them rather than just to take, you know, the statement from the quote-unquote anonymous government officials and just parrot the government line. You know, the individuals, we really are the last defense, and that is when you recognize that the media in this country and really around the world is controlled by a handful of corporations. And if you want to find real information, you got to go out there and find it yourself. So, you know, I feel like I've gone from writing blogs or whatever, you know, you could term blogs, essays, et cetera, by analyzing the news and seeing what's going on and putting my viewpoints. But I've also done a lot of on-the-ground work, going with my own camera, with my own audio recorder, asking the questions myself, you know, to Ferguson, to Boston, to Arizona, to a bunch of different places, to cover stories that I think are important or to be on the scene whenever there's something going down and when I just don't trust that the media is going to ask the questions that I care about or that my audience cares about.
Yeah, and this is, and on your website, this is really evident, theconsciousresistance.com, again, is that site. And when you talk about guys with suits, you've got a friend. I mean, one thing that really struck me about this website is that the collaboration and with various other platforms and people, and it seems more like a network. And when you talk about, you know, a guy with a suit on television on a mainstream channel, well, you're connected to one just such a guy, Ben Swan. What's the nature of that collaboration? And maybe you could describe to us up here who don't see Ben Swan, or most of us probably don't know who he is, what's the nature of that relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. If the audience is not aware of who Ben Swan is, I do advise check out truthandmedia.com, which is Ben's current website that he runs. But he's a Lone Star. He's originally from Texas, actually, but he's a Lone Star Emmy Award-winning journalist. He's won the Edward Murrow Award several times for his journalism when he was younger. He's just a really brilliant guy. He used to work at a Fox affiliate in Cincinnati, and then he went independent after they started to basically censor him because he does a really powerful report called The Reality Check, and just does really well-trained in that old-school style of journalism we were talking about, but also somebody who's willing to say, you know what, when I went to journalism school and the people I work with at these stations, we're taught to be broadcasters, not journalists. So, you know, he'll openly talk about when they say, hey, we can't run this Hillary Clinton, you know, piece because our advertisers or whatever. So he's been very much supported by activists and people such as myself and independent alternative media because he's been able to crack into that world and work in the mainstream. He has that mainstream look, the suit and tie, the nice hair. You know, the middle America is going to listen to him before they probably would listen to me, based on looks, which is silly itself, but we know that that plays a role. And as far as that goes, Ben has that really well down. I started working with him in 2012 or so, around the last election, there was third-party debates were being held by a couple of different organizations, helped organize, you know, Libertarian Green Party, Constitutional Party, and some other parties. And it was hosted by RT. It was pretty much ignored by all the mainstream. And Ben was supposed to be hosting that debate. And just out of chance, you know, we interviewed one of the organizers of that event that night on a radio program that I used to do. And the guy just kind of offhandedly said that Ben Swan was no longer participating because he had been warned not to participate by the Fox affiliate he was working at. So I was like, oh, wow, that's an interesting piece of information. And the next day, you know, I woke up and I realized that nobody else had that information and that it wasn't being reported anywhere, you know, within an independent alternative or anywhere. So I put out an article and wrote it and got it out there, and it went a little viral, and then Ben ended up contacting me and basically said, he asked me to make a correction. Not, you know, he didn't say that there was anything I got wrong. He just said those words weren't used. That's all he would really say about it. And but shortly after that, he left Fox affiliate anyways, and as I said, went independent. Now he's back at CBS in Atlanta. He's working there now. But I talk to him on a pretty regular basis, and we do interviews. You know, I definitely, as I said, have a lot of respect for him, and you know, I think the respect is mutual.
Well, you know, and I linked from your site, again, theconsciousresistance.com, to the Truth in Media site, Ben's site, and looked at some of his CBS reports, and I was amazed. Some of the things he was reporting on and the way he was reporting on it on a CBS station, I was slack-jawed watching it.
Yeah, that seems to be the response for a lot of people. You watch it, and you're like, whoa, this is on TV? This seems like there's too much truth in this for this to get played on TV.
Yeah, it's not like it's not like most of us didn't know it. It's just seeing it in that venue. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Derek Brose. Derek, as I said, is the author of theconsciousresistance.com, a cool website. And you talked about blogging and getting into a citizen journalism, as I call it, or journalism proper, however we want to classify this. But you also moved into producing a book that I mentioned too, The Conscious Resistance, Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality. Well, now, Derek, I've always had a hard time understanding anarchy, and I know a lot of other people do. They think anarchists are throwing petrol bombs or whatever. Could you give us a thumbnail of what anarchy means to you?
Absolutely. You know, and that image, like you said, conjures up in people's minds this idea of throwing Molotov cocktails or violence or chaos. And, you know, some would say that's a purposeful effort that's been done over generations, because when you really start to get beyond just that surface level understanding of anarchy and what, you know, the way it's used in more of the mainstream world and media, movies and television, and look at the history of it, you understand that anarchism is actually a philosophy of freedom that has been around since the 18th century. And the ideas, I mean, have been around for probably since the beginning of humanity, you know, but as far as in the written form and people identifying that this is a school of thought where we value these things, that's been going on since the 18th century. And, you know, just like any school of thought, any philosophy, there's a lot of different branches. There's a lot of variations and, you know, who thinks this is the right way to go about it, et cetera, et cetera. But at the heart of it is essentially the idea that human beings are capable enough and evolving to the point of being able to take care of their own affairs and their own interactions with each other, you know, for mutual benefit, for, you know, building community and to, you know, living in a productive way that we all have grown accustomed to, but without the need for government, without the need for the state and for that inherent violence that is imposed by the state. Because, you know, if you decide one day that you don't think you need to pay taxes, or you can't find any legitimate moral reason why you owe the government money on your income, say, for example, well, then men with guns will come to your house and they will round you up and put you in a cage. And so that's one example of where you're not free. And so when you start to examine all these different areas and you see the ways that the state imposes its will, and then, of course, the employees of that state impose their will, whether consciously or unconsciously, upon you, then you realize that, you know, we are not as free as we would like to believe. Yes, there's, you know, you can argue the United States is freer than other places, but as I said, I think that we're evolving, and many thinkers have said this for a while, that we're evolving to the point of not needing a government, which, looking at the world today, can seem pretty far off, like, wow, I think that, you know, you're insane. There's no way I can see all this chaos in the world ever coming to a point of, you know, working together in a balance. And I definitely can resonate with that statement. And I have issue with a lot of things going on in the world. But I also see change happening in specifically in the United States and abroad, where individuals are starting to challenge this narrative, this idea that government knows best, that authority knows best, and to start to look to ourselves for answers, and then look within our own communities for answers. And so anarchy is essentially the philosophy that says that we are each capable as individuals to come together to come to our own agreements upon, you know, how we should live and how we can and organize. It doesn't mean that there is no government necessarily. it means that there's no hierarchy. There's this like no hierarchical above authoritarian top-down centralized control that exists. So, you know, communities could still decide how they want to handle the environment. They could still build roads. They could still take care of everything that we've become accustomed to. It would just be done. And, you know, this is where the theories diverge based on which specific path you want to take. But these things could still be done without this inherent force that I was discussing, you know, the force of government. And so it's just, it's a philosophy that questions whether government is immoral, whether the state is moral, and if we have really stopped evolving, if we've gotten to the point where, you know, things are as good as they're going to get, or if we can get somewhere that feels more free and more, you know, it provides for our needs.
Well, and the idea that there's a spiritual element to this, I find really interesting as well, because, I mean, there is freedom and freedom, you know, in the societal sense. But there's also the freedom of soul, the freedom of spirit. Is that what you're getting at in your book when you talk about when you marry anarchism and spirituality?
Yeah, so, you know, the idea of the book, The Conscious Resistance, Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality, which I do want to just throw out there for anyone who's interested that you can download it for free on the website. Go to theconsciousresistance.com. There's a book tab, and you can read all about what it's about. You can check out the chapters and download it for free, and if you like it, you can order one. But the idea of the book is myself and my co-author, John Vimes, basically, before we met, as you know, we both kind of had our own individual paths coming to this understanding of what I was just discussing about anarchist philosophy and exploring that. And we both also seem to have experiences that took us towards a place of questioning, you know, the world, trying to understand things, and different experiences, like maybe with, you know, some psychedelics or just life-changing experiences and starting to evaluate what makes sense and all these different things, the big questions, you know, you ponder about life that kind of lead you down that spiritual, that bigger, deeper path. And upon doing that, I started to see just these incredible similarities and similar veins of thought in these two different worlds. Like I said, I delve in both political activist world and spiritual world, and on one hand I see people who are pursuing deep understanding of what God means or what the universe means or what nature is, and they're on this spiritual path to understand themselves and the world and everything around them, and they're totally in the state of complete freedom. You know, they're not being held back by a religious institution, by a priest, by, you know, any other person. They're letting their own experience and their, you know, their self-reflection guide them. And to me, that was like, wow, that is anarchy in action. That, you know, that is powerful. So we, you know, we started having these discussions, and before we knew it, we were like, okay, I think we have a book here. And we started writing last October. We released the book earlier this year, or last year, I guess now, April 2015. And the book covers our basic philosophy. The first part of the book looks at these ideas, how we see the world as far as anarchy and spirituality. You know, what we see is that before the state came along, individuals were allowed to be free. You have indigenous communities, native communities all around the world, not just in America, but tribes of Europe, people finding ways to organize. And it wasn't perfect. We're not saying that things were perfect then, but people weren't living with this imposed force above them. There was definitely kings and there were situations like that. But we have throughout history there are examples of people trying to live in a stateless way. And also, before the religious institutions came along and declared these certain churches to be the only path towards God or towards understanding the universe, people were free to interpret nature as they please, you know. And that's where we see that the state come along, the church come along, and they burn the quote-unquote witches at stake, or they burn the pagans at stake, the heretics at the stake. And the same thing, the people who were talking about freedom, who wanted to live without the state, the anarchists, they were demonized, they were imprisoned, they were jailed, they were, you know, the word itself was demonized. And so we're trying to reclaim that and show people from, you know, either of these categories. Because the other thing is, living in both these worlds, I see people who are on the spiritual side of things and who are interested in meditation and those type of ideas, but they have an aversion towards political ideas or philosophy because they kind of want to talk about the good things. They don't want to think about the bad because that's, you know, going to make things worse and that kind of mentality. So I was struggling with that. And then on the other side, I was running in these political activist anarchist circles and finding plenty of people who are militantly atheists and who, you know, didn't want to have any conversation about belief or religion or spirituality or anything of the like. And so we're trying to bring these two different worlds together to show them that there's plenty of common ground. There's a lot to learn from each other. So the first part of the book does that. The second half looks at various religious beliefs, Christianity, Islam, shamanism, Buddhism, Taoism, and shows that the roots of these belief systems are actually rooted in anti-authoritarian belief, you know, that this, that anarchist thought is common throughout history when you really look for it. And try to give it, you know, a historical background to show people these ideas have existed. There is, you know, there's they're relative and they're important, they're valuable. And we've actually since then realized that that book is going to be the first of a trilogy. We're actually releasing the second book in that trilogy this April at the Free Your Mind Conference in Philadelphia. That book is going to be called Finding Freedom in an Age of Confusion. And it's going to look at some different elements, but yeah, we've got a three-part thing that we're working on here, we've realized now.
Well, you certainly have the timing right. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. Again, I'm speaking with Derek Brose. Derek's a freelance journalist, community activist, gardener, and promoter from Houston, and co-author of the book, The Conscious Resistance, Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality, of which we were just talking about. You know, we get a lot of American media up here in Canada, Derek, and we're watching, a lot of us, with great interest, what's going on in Oregon right now. You know, when you mentioned libertarianism, and there's a spiritual, or at least a religiosity, a religious element to what's going on in this big standoff down in the Malheur wildlife refuge. I'm interested in what your take on what's going on down there is and how it relates to this idea of freedom and separation from the government, especially the federal government.
So I just finished an article about 20 minutes ago on this thing, and it's pretty long, but I think these topics are, you know, they get chewed up in the media, the left-wing media, the right-wing media, the corporate media, and then everybody takes their stance, and it's like, oh, these people are racist bigots. We, you know, the government should go attack them. Or the other side is just reactionary, like, oh, you know, people who are against the government, I support them. You know, and I feel like we have to think, we have to encourage each other to think deeper and to look at these situations as they are, which is very nuanced. There's a lot of layers to this, and to me, I feel like on one front, there is the idea that the federal government is, you know, constantly overreaching and growing and intruding on people's lives in a number of ways, whether it's the idea of slowly taking land from ranchers or massive surveillance or, you know, whatever, you know, wars of aggression. We have a lot of examples of federal government overreach and legitimate criticisms for the federal government. And I think those are important to remember, whether or not you agree with this specific situation. You know, you can disagree with these guys and the standoff that's taking place in Oregon and still say, but hey, I think they have a right to exercise their voice. Or hey, I think that there is, you know, something legitimate to argue about the government. And I think people forget that as well. Like, we don't have to necessarily endorse every, you know, every topic that, you know, the other side talks about or every action they take, but we can see, we can still be willing to admit when the government's wrong, because all I've really seen, and this is something I guess just more of an analysis of the media's take on this, is this, these type of situations are easy ways to divide people. And as I said, everybody takes their position, whether they think these people are this or whether they think they're that. And then, you know, we debate each other, argue, and people just stick to their biases. And I really feel like if we were able to get more people focused on where's the common ground, where can we work together, maybe I don't agree with these people taking their guns and, you know, taking over this building in this stance, but I'm willing to work with them on this area, you know, things like that. If we had more of that type of mentality and building bridges rather than breaking each other down, then I think that these, many of these problems that we're facing would be, you know, would be handled by now.
Well, Derek, it's, again, your website is really interesting. It's theconsciousresistance.com, and the links to it are myriad, and your video reports are incisive and also interesting, and I really recommend our listeners go to it, check it out. Thanks a lot, Derek, for coming on and telling us a little bit about us today, and I'll look forward to the second installment in your book series.
All right, thank you for having me on, Chris. I'll talk to you soon.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. On April 12th, the Global Research News Hour had the opportunity to meet and speak with a participant and co-founder of one of the most dynamic protest movements in recent years. We addressed the limitation of protest as a vehicle for political and social change. The interview you're about to hear was conducted in advance of a presentation at McNally Robinson Booksellers in Winnipeg that evening. So this is Michael Welch for CKW Radio. I've got a very special guest here in the studio. You want to identify yourself?
Yeah, my name is Michael White. I'm the author of The End of Protest, okay. A new playbook for revolution.
And it's also worthy of note that you were one of the co-founders of Occupy Wall Street.
I was, yes. I was one of the co-creators of Occupy Wall Street.
Okay. So do you want to, I can't resist. I mean, you want to tell us a little bit about how Occupy Wall Street got started and you have that initial vision and what it turned into. I'm just curious to know how your insights into that whole scenario.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if you go back to that kind of magical time, 2011, you remember that, you know, it got kicked off with this basically a fruit seller in Tunisia setting himself on fire to protest against the confiscation of his fruit cart. And that kind of unleashed this pent up rage against the autocratic rulers in the Arab world. And that rage spread to Egypt, where they had a day of rage that turned into an occupation. They didn't call it an occupation, but an uprising, an encampment in Tahrir Square. And then Egypt, when they overthrew Mubarak, the movement spread and grew, and it went to Spain. And then the people of Spain started going to the squares. So at that time, I was working at Adbusters Magazine, which is an anti-consumerist magazine based in Vancouver. And the founder and I were close collaborators, and we were brainstorming, like, how can we bring this revolutionary wave to America? And so we wrote a tactical briefing, basically an email to our readers that said, hey, everyone, if we can combine the tactics of the Tahrir uprising with the tactics of the consensus-based assemblies happening in Spain and bring that to Wall Street, then we can kick off a revolutionary moment in America and possibly around the world. And basically, you know, within 24 hours of sending out that email, the idea got taken up by activists in New York City. They started planning for the action, and we basically gave the movement to the participants. It became a leaderless movement where the participants dictated the direction of the movement. So we created the idea, but everything else was up to the participants.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of those participants, were there any significant tensions between the reformers versus the revolutionaries, or was it a fairly consistent or unanimous?
Well, I think, you know, in the earliest days, the reality is that the many of the forces who are currently associated with Occupy Wall Street weren't there. The unions and the big NGOs and the famous, you know, Michael Moores and all these people, they weren't there. They didn't think it was a good idea. The only people who responded to the call of Occupy Wall Street were true believers who saw the potential of the idea, perhaps because they had been watching what's going on in Spain, or they just had that call of destiny. They got it, that this was going to work. And there was about 200 of them. And those 200 people were not the usual activists seen. They were outsiders. And so the movement was created by outsiders. And I think that there wasn't really a tension between reform and revolution. I mean, there was some early tension between do we accept union support or not. But I think that the key tension was, and you know, is this idea called prefigurative anarchism, which is basically this idea that we don't make demands, we just build the ideal society. And I had never heard of prefigurative anarchism before. And so when the Occupy Wall Street idea went to the activists of New York who were entrenched in this prefigurative anarchism idea, that seeped into the movement's culture. And that's why no demands were really made and this kind of thing. So, you know, that's one of the twists of fate that happened, is that we didn't get to pick who believed in the idea. And it just so happened that the people who believed in the idea also believed in another idea, prefigurative anarchism, which turned out to be not an effective strategy of social change. But we had to test that hypothesis. We went with the hypothesis, we tested it, and it wasn't true.
It sounded valid at the time, though.
it sounds like a really, it's magical thinking.
In theory.
In theory, it's wonderful until you realize that you can't build the microcosm of the utopian society in lower Manhattan. If you know what I mean? Like, it's not real. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I call Occupy Wall Street a constructive failure, which is that we were trying to gain sovereignty. And we were doing that through these behaviors that we thought would give us sovereignty, such as holding consensus-based assemblies, being a better form of democracy, not making demands, you know. And so those were attempts at magical thinking, at trying to give ourselves sovereignty. Well, we realized, no, you can't get sovereignty that way. You have to get sovereignty either by winning elections or winning wars. And that's I think, where social movements are at right now.
Hmm. And one of the perennial bugaboos that affects any of these social movements and social – is the whole divide and conquer thing, whether it's deliberately imposed by people in high places or just the idiosyncrasies of human nature. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you – could you comment on that aspect of it where you're seeing these divisions starting to infect and ultimately break up that movement?
Well, I think you have to remember that if it's like winning the lottery, okay? So there's 200 people who believed in the idea. All of a sudden, it spirals into something that's in 82 countries. We had 1,000 encampments, even in Winnipeg. Everyone's doing this thing. And all of the attention is focused on those founders in New York City, because where New York City goes, the movement goes. I mean, a little bit later, Oakland started to influence things. But basically, so much psychological and social pressure is placed on social movement creators. In fact, if you look at Kony 2012, the creator of that, he went crazy. He went, got naked in the streets running around, and he lost his mind temporarily. And, so I think that the divide and conquer, I think the way that that really plays out with social movements is that you are not only placed under a tremendous amount of police infiltration, police surveillance, police oppression, but there's a tremendous amount of social pressure amongst each other. And then once things start to, which is okay in the beginning, but then once things start to turn more sour and resources become more scarce, then everyone starts to fight with each other. And fortunately, I wasn't in New York. We created the idea. I was living in Berkeley, and Adbusters is based in Vancouver. And so I was largely able to kind of stay out of that whole scene. But, that's kind of the reality of when you create a global event, it's a lot of pressure.
Mm. Are the activists keeping up with the cops and the forces of authority?
Well, I mean, I think that I tend to think that activists today, they complain too much about this thing. I mean, let's be real. Like, if you go back to the 19th century, the early 20th century, Lenin and the Russian communists, they dealt with the most sophisticated secret police that existed in Europe, run by the Tsar. The Tsar invented, basically secret police and infiltration and all this kind of stuff. At one point, Trotsky writes that at one point, three out of the seven leading Bolsheviks in Russia or something were police spies. That Lenin's secretary was a police spy. So, I mean, let's be real. Throughout human history, revolutionaries have faced with overwhelming police oppression. I think that activists today complain about it too much. I think that if the Russian Revolution was able to happen, even though they were, oppressed with all these secret police and the czars, then obviously that the secret police will never be able to stop a revolution. I think the activists need to turn it back on themselves and say, look, we didn't lose because of the police repression. We lost because our theory of social change was incorrect. And that's fine. It's not like we shouldn't be upset about that. We had to test those theories. But it also is a learning moment. It's like, okay, our theory of social change was incorrect. We can come up with a better and more accurate theory of social change. The police can't stop us. The police are just, they're again, a symptom. Obviously, when you create a revolutionary moment, there's going to be police who are going to try to mess you up. It's like complaining that you're playing basketball and the other team has players. It's like, get real. Like, this is what reality is. So, I don't know. I'm not too
concerned. Just don't learn. You just learn from those past struggles to not duplicate the same mistakes over and over.
Totally. Activists should always be like three or four steps ahead of the police. And if you look at the way social movements happen, there's always a gap between the emergence of the social movement, and it always takes a certain amount of time for police to figure out the effective form of repression. And so you always have at least, I don't know, I would say 28 days, but basically you always have at least a certain amount of time before the repression becomes overwhelming.
Mm. Could you talk about these, looking ahead, looking to the future, these modes of revolution that we must, enter into or reconcile with in order to achieve a successful end?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that, the thing about revolution that's so fascinating is it always comes as a surprise. And that makes it very difficult to predict. That's why sometimes people say it's spontaneous. Well, obviously we know it's not spontaneous. There's always people who secretly know this event, we're creating this event. But anyways, revolutions come as a surprise. So at the same time, activists need to think, well, what where could they come from? You know, that's part of our goal, is to figure out where could these surprises come from next. And so for me, I think I see like three revolutionary scenarios for where the next revolution could come from. I think that on the one hand, we could have a revolution could come from the rural areas. I live in a rural town of 280 people in Oregon. And I think living there has really taught me that these places are less policed, and they have a different culture. They have there's something special about the culture that's developing in the rural areas. So I could imagine a kind of rural secessionist movement growing. Also, I think that another place that we could see some revolution is women. I think women are could rise up. I mean, right now we're seeing an amazing kind of situation developing at UC Berkeley, where the systemic harassment and sexual harassment of women by faculty members, by professors, tenured professors, is reaching a blow-up point. So I think that I can imagine a kind of social movement where we wake up one day and suddenly there's women of all ages protesting the streets and new forms of activism, and we're like, what is this? I don't understand. And then that movement spreads. And then the third kind of revolutionary scenario that I imagine is, I think we can imagine the birth of autonomous, like, kind of protest bots or protest computer programs that basically sit on Twitter and Facebook and propagandize and spread social movements. And basically just, you know, we create them and then we deploy them, and they go out there and they create these social movements. And that sounds kind of far-fetched, but then, of course, we just a few months ago, Twitter had to shut down like 100,000 ISIS bots or something like that. So it's like literally this, you know, and we know that Russia's using bots on the social network. So bots are going to be here. And so I think activists can use them too.
I know in my country, Canada, there's been a growth in indigenous activism and indigenous resistance. And I mean, we've had spectacular examples. There was Gustafson Lake a couple of decades now, just about. And I'm thinking that for the state authorities, that is something they really need to reconcile with. And so we're hearing a lot of messaging about the nation to nation that sort of thing. That really stands out from my perspective as possibly the biggest in this country, the biggest potential nexus for real revolutionary pressure.
Yeah.
I was just kind of curious to know what your thoughts are looking at what's been happening with regard to indigenous resistance to extractivist industries and such.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that kind of ties into this whole rural thing. I mean, I agree absolutely. It seems to me that that could be one of the revolutionary scenarios. I mean, I think it's like it's a matter of, you know, at a concrete level, social movements are created out of three things. First, you need a willing historical moment. You need a contagious mood, and then you need a new tactic. So I think that none of us can control the historical moment, but I do think that I could imagine a new mood that kind of spreads throughout indigenous communities. Are like Idle No More, basically, you know, like we're waking up, we are idle no more, and then using new forms of protest where the goal though isn't to raise awareness or all this other stuff, but actually gain sovereignty, you know. So, and I think that if once we see social protests who keep their eye on the prize. A lot of activism has been degraded into just trying to spread awareness, which is not the goal. The goal is sovereignty. The goal is to become the people in power. Yeah, so I think, yeah, for sure, it could come from the indigenous areas.
Well, I only got time for one more question now, but I really felt I wanted to put this to you. We're seeing the unexpected rise of presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, who is using a lot of the language from Occupy Wall Street. And I'm thinking, you know, is this somehow a kind of the progeny of Occupy in a sense? I mean, what are your thoughts about that movement, if you want to call it that, behind Bernie Sanders? Is this something that Occupy can take some degree of credit for, or
I mean, of
is
course,
there a connection there?
Yeah, of course, Occupy can take some credit. I mean, we fundamentally changed the culture in America and all this kind of stuff. And so Bernie Sanders is symptomatic of our movement. But at the same time, you know, I think we shouldn't confuse the head with the tail. And I think a lot of activists, they start chasing the tail, which means they start chasing Bernie Sanders as if Bernie Sanders is the leader and that we need. No, Occupy Wall Street created Bernie Sanders. I mean, Occupy Wall Street was the head and Bernie Sanders is the tail. And what we need is another head. And I think that also we need to learn, you know, Occupy was right not to put its faith in leaders. We've already learned from the experience of the 20th century revolutionaries that putting your hopes in leaders, even one who seems as good as Bernie Sanders, is not going to work. That we've had the Czech Republic had a politician just as good as Bernie Sanders, and it also didn't work. So Yeah, we have to stop. We stop putting our faith in leaders and start putting it back into the social movements.
Michael White is the author of The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution, available at your nearest independent bookstore. Pick up a copy. Michael White, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
What follows now is audio from Michael White's presentation at McNally Robinson Booksellers in Winnipeg, which was structured as an interview between himself and local anti-poverty activist and former journalist Donald Benham.
Yeah, so I mean, if you think about it, what the fundamental thing that protest is, what are protesters doing when they protest, okay? What protesters are trying to do is they're doing a behavior they believe will create social change. And even, and I think even more specifically, what they're trying to do is they're trying to manifest some sort of sovereignty. They're trying to say basically, like we said with Occupy Wall Street, these assemblies, basically what we were saying is, look, these assemblies, these consensus-based assemblies that are involving all these different kinds of people, these are like an ideal form of democracy, and it's happening right now, it's happening all over the world. Therefore, society should basically listen to what we're saying here. And not only that, the police shouldn't be able to evict us because somehow we have like sovereignty over the police. The police should be working for the people, and we are the people. So basically what you're seeing here is it's an argument about sovereignty. Okay, so if protest doesn't give us sovereignty, if marching with millions of people in the streets doesn't just give us sovereignty magically, which is something that activists, I think, have believed. It sounds kind of ridiculous, but I think that is something that we believe. There are two ways to gain sovereignty in this world in which we live. There's winning wars and there's winning elections. That's it. So I don't think social movements right now should try to think they can win wars. We've seen what happened in the Arab world when Libya slid into civil war, Syria slid into civil war. Civil war and war seems to be the death of social movements and the death of positive social change. So winning elections. Social movements can win elections. In fact, we're seeing in Europe that social movements are able to, like in Spain, they have this thing called Podemos, and Podemos has become within 2 or 3 years a major political party in Spain, and they are using decentralized, you know, somewhat leaderless tactics to gain power, to gain actual sovereignty. So that, you know, that's basically where we're going is, and we need to see social movements capture sovereignty.
At the end of the book, you talk about the importance of personal transformation. You share that you've chosen to live in a smaller community in Oregon. Are you planning to run for office there? Is that the next logical step in trying to establish what you want?
Well, so if we want to talk like concretely about this question, so after Occupy Wall Street, at the time I was living in Berkeley, and my wife and I moved to the rural Oregon coast. Where we live is 280 people, a tiny little town. And what's amazing though about this tiny little town is it's actually a city. So they have a city council, they have a mayor. And all of a sudden when you think about how, well, we want sovereign institutions, here's a sovereign institution that is being run currently by people who are well beyond retirement age. This is rural. I mean, they're not only wanting to retire, they're like happy to have someone else step up to the plate. And so, yeah, I think we do think about, well, could the people of Nehalem, that's the name of our town, take control of the city council? Now, the question though, and I think in terms of a broader plan of taking control of multiple rural communities, but in terms of whether or not I should run for office, to me that seems like a regression and a mistake. I think that too much emphasis is placed on these leaders, you know? And I think that I prefer the idea that the social movement should have delegates from themselves, that we should have delegates who step forward and say, okay, I'm gonna like represent the social movement's will by holding this position, but you know, I'm interchangeable with someone else and I'm merely here to kind of like speak what this movement wants. Otherwise, you just get into a position like we saw with Syriza in Greece, where it's like, you know, they flatter your ego, and all of a sudden they start to think, no, you know, you don't have to listen to your movement. So, no, I think that unless there is a real fundamental reason why it had to be me in particular, I think that it's better to like develop the leadership from within.
I've heard you mention some of these other European movements and getting on the ballot and so on. What about the Green Party? The Greens as a movement and Greens as a party, they're running in an election right here in Manitoba, and they run for federal politics in Canada as well. Does that seem like any kind of model to you of trying to bring into effect social change?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, what we're describing is something that isn't just, it's not a new idea. Like, if you go back to, like, you know, like, even Marx would talk about, oh, we need to establish an international working men's association, and that somehow these working men's associations are going to gain power all over the world. Or if even if you go to the Russian Revolution, they started to say, well, the Russian Revolution won't succeed unless we have revolutions in other places. Like, we need some sort of supranational movement that can gain power. And so the Green Party is also a manifestation of this same concept. But I think that the Green Party, as it's currently conceived, seems to have failed in achieving that particular vision. And I think that it has to do with, like, right now it seems to me that we have new methods of social movement creation that should be used. I think that what I'm describing would be more of a situation where you have a party that uses street protests strategically and the ability to mobilize large numbers of people to do new kinds of behaviors around elections. So, I mean, if the Green Party started, like, mobilizing, you know, certain people around the election to swing the election, then maybe we would see something. But I think it seems to me that in each country they kind of still play it safe and think, like, no, I'm going to rationally convince people to vote for me. There's actually a really interesting thing I like to think about, which is that, you know, people don't vote for the strongest. They don't vote for the strongest horse. They vote for the horse they think is going to win. And so I think a lot of activists spend so much time building what they call, like, the biggest movement, or this will be the biggest mass arrest. And really, what we need to be doing is building social movements that people think are going to win. You know, so I don't think many people think the Green Party is going to win, but the Green Party could surprise us all. So.
But isn't that part of the internal contradiction? Because what you said happened to the Green Party, they're trying to become more acceptable to more of the electorate, and in doing that, shed more and more of being a social movement and become more of a conventional political party. You have to rely on money, which is, you know, to be in politics, which is what Occupy Wall Street was all about. Isn't turning social movements into contests of the ballot box inevitably going to suck what's truly their essence? Out of them.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that what you're highlighting obviously is a challenge of what, you know, so basically there's three options for protesters. Number one, first option, we can just keep doing what we're doing right now. They just had an event in Washington, D.C. 400 people kind of, like, did a scripted arrest. Great. Got a lot of tweets on Twitter. I don't think it's going to change anything. I think anyone who thinks it's going to change anything, I mean, it's being very idealistic. Let's just say that Occupy Wall Street had 700 people arrested simultaneously on the Brooklyn Bridge. It was much bigger, you know, and we lasted a lot longer. So all I'm saying is that we can keep putting it's like a lottery. We can keep playing the lottery thinking we're going to hit big with the same tactics. Or we can say, fine, we're not going to protest. We're going to do some sort of, like, urban guerrilla, you know, insurrectionary strategy also created in the 1970s around the time of the Green Party. That also doesn't seem likely. Each of these options presents its own difficulties and challenges. So the third option, building social movements that can win and swing elections, and not just swing elections in one country, but swing elections in multiple countries to create a kind of supranational social movement that governs multiple countries to carry out a unified geopolitical agenda. That's what we're really talking about. What we're talking about is, how do you solve climate change? Well, you need a global social movement that controls multiple countries. So that presents even more astronomical challenges than what you're raising, which is, won't you be co-opted by the system? Here's the even bigger challenge. How do you make decisions if a social movement were to win elections in three different countries, would it carry out the same unified policies in each one, like they tried to do with, like, the Russian Comintern, you know, like, or would it have different manifestations in each country? What I'm saying is, these are the challenges that we have to work through. You know, what you do is you see them, and then it's like, yeah, you have to address these things. But on the question of money, I do think that social movements can win elections more cheaply than contemporary politics. And the example I use in my book is the Five Star Movement in Italy, which wins elections in Italy with just, like, pennies per vote, whereas, you know, Obama's paying, like, $10 a vote or something like that.
I think you've got a lot of people here, and I know some of the faces of people who would really like to hear about what they could do as an individual or with groups they know to carry forward some of the ideas you were talking about. Do you have any advice for people here?
Well, I'm going to respond at kind of a theoretical level, because I think, to be honest with you, when you try to give prescriptive actions to people, it fails. And so what I do want to say, one thing that we haven't touched on in this interview so far, is what I call, like, my unified theory of revolution in my book, okay? And so I think that if you were to think about how does social change happen, in my book I talk about basically there's four paradigms, okay? So the first paradigm is the dominant theory of social activism. It's called voluntarism. It's the idea that human actions create change. So if we want to change the world, we have to get large numbers of people to do direct action. We've all heard that term, direct action, you know, march in the streets, these kind of things. So that's the dominant paradigm of social activism, and it's partially true. There's another theory, though, which is called structuralism. And that's the idea that human action doesn't cause revolutions. Instead, revolutions are a material process outside of human control. And we're familiar with this from like Marxist historical materialism, where they say things like, well, you can't have it like Trotsky. You can't have a revolution without an economic crisis. Okay? And there's been some really interesting studies that have shown that revolutions tend to occur when the food prices reach a certain threshold. So under this theory, you can't have a revolution unless there's high food prices. Well, surprise, we're living in a time of epically low food prices. Okay, so there's a third option, though, and that's subjectivism. It's the idea that if you want to change the world, then you have to change how you see the world. And this is something that I think, you know, people kind of grasp, because if you like have a breakup or something and you're all depressed, the whole world seems dark. But when you like fall in love, everything's so great again, right? And so under this theory, we would have to get away from the kind of apocalyptic, catastrophic leftist discourse that even at Adversus I was so, you know, helping to push forward, and instead see that like the world is a beautiful place and all this kind of, you know, meditate and stuff like that. And then there's the fourth option, and this is the idea that revolution is not a process that involves humans, and it's not a process that involves the natural world. It's instead a spiritual or supernatural process. This is probably the most esoteric or controversial part of this paradigm. I call it theurgy, which literally means God work. You know, it's what they call sorcery. So, but this has to do with this an example of this one would be the conquest of Christianity. Christianity didn't win through street protests. Christianity won because St. Paul had a vision of Jesus and Constantine had a dream of Jesus too. So I want to leave, I'll just leave, I know that's like, those are four big ideas. And what I'm saying is that all four are true. And the role of the activist is to mix the four in the proper proportion for the historical moment in which they live. And this is the fundamental thing that people, I think one of the reasons why we get tripped up. It may have been true in the 19th and early 20th century that we needed to have a heavy emphasis on structuralism combined with voluntarism. You know, maybe Marx was correct in his analysis. But I think it's more true now that we need a higher dose of subjectivism and theurgy. Okay, now the theurgy thing is really hard, so I'm going to leave you guys with one crazy thought, which I just started to kind of research, and this is really interesting. In 1922, there was this Russian cosmologist, and he did a study of sunspot activity, and he found that revolutions in history for the last 2,000 years have coincided with high sunspot activity. Sunspots follow an 11-year solar cycle. Okay. This idea sounds ridiculous, and he was actually sent into the Stalinist gulag for 8 years of hard labor because that idea violates the core principles of most leftist materialism. So he wrote that in 1922. I'm kidding you not. If you go and check out the sunspots on September 17, 2011, the first day of Occupy Wall Street, record high sunspot activity on the first day of Occupy Wall Street. So what does that mean? Well, one thing is that they're predicting that we're entering a period of sustained low sunspot activity. We're at the downswing in the sunspot activity. So all I'm saying is that in those times in which revolution seems far away, it's beholden on the activists to keep their faith, to realize that revolution always comes again, and to prepare for it, and to build for it. But not to waste your energy. If you believe that we're in one of those moments, maybe you don't believe, so keep going, you know, but I think that what's distinguished successful revolutionaries in the past is their ability to pause and act when necessary.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to CKUW volunteer Susan Hubert for supplying the audio from the Micah White Talk. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.